Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Criminal legal system reforms are being introduced at a rapid pace across the U.S., often with the stated goal of reducing our extreme prison and jail populations. Too often, however, these reforms are handicapped because they exclude large categories of people impacted by the criminal legal system. These carve-outs generally exclude people charged with or convicted of violent, sex-related, or other serious charges. This is sometimes referred to as focusing on the non-non-nons, non-violent, non-sexual, and non-serious charges. So-called serious charges often include drug crimes that involve specific controlled substances like fentanyl or methamphetamines. Too often, policymakers believe that these carve-outs are politically necessary in order to pass legislation, or they may actually believe that they're good policy. Well, the Prison Policy Initiative has gathered a set of resources for advocates and policymakers to understand the problems posed by carve-outs and to equip them with arguments to make sure that criminal legal reform can be for everyone, not just for a small subset of impacted people. To discuss carve-outs and this new toolkit, I'm joined by Wanda Bertram, communications strategist at the Prison Policy Initiative. Wanda, welcome.
Hi there.
Let's start with that word carve-out. What are carve-outs?
Yeah. Over the last 20 years, there have been a lot of pretty major reforms to the criminal justice system. But they've come with a big catch, and carve-outs are the catch. A carve-out is when a criminal justice reform or other law excludes some of the people who stand to benefit from that law. So, for example, Florida a couple of years ago passed a law that restored voting rights to people who were leaving prison, people who have felony records. But they carved out people convicted of certain violent and sexual offenses from that reform. So if you are convicted of a murder, or if you're convicted of I believe it's rape and other certain sexual offenses, you don't benefit from this law in Florida. You do not get your right to vote restored, no matter the circumstances of the individual case, no matter, you know, how long it's been since you were incarcerated. Florida is known for having extremely draconian punishments. So this is something that does not just apply to this one law. It applies to almost every major criminal justice reform that's happened over the last 20 years. Some group of people, usually people, quote unquote, violent offenses, have been cut out of these reforms. I'll just give a quick rundown of the things that some of the things that people with violent offenses have been excluded from in criminal justice reform. Just in the last 5 years alone, right? People have been excluded from the ability to earn parole, the ability to earn good time credits, so earning time off of your sentence for good behavior while you're inside. People convicted of violent offenses have been excluded from, as I said, voting rights. They've been excluded from pretrial diversion. So everybody gets the opportunity to be diverted from the criminal justice system pretrial, unless you're charged with, you know, particular violent offenses. They have been excluded from post-trial diversion to probation. So probation is an alternative to incarceration. They've been excluded from veterans treatment courts, from occupational licensing reform, right? A certain occupation like nursing reforms its occupational licensing rules. So it doesn't matter anymore whether you have a felony record, unless it's a violent offense. They've been excluded from expungement laws, right? So, for example, in a few states, there were laws passed where people who were victims of sex trafficking, incarcerated people who were themselves previously victims of sex trafficking, got a special kind of waiver to have their criminal records expunged. And this law excluded people convicted of violent offenses. So if you are a person who is a victim of sex trafficking and your crime happened to be a crime of violence, maybe against the person that was trafficking you, you're carved out of this law that would allow for expungement of your record. That's just a particular example. They've been carved out of geriatric and medical parole. The list is just so long. I can't keep going down it, but there's so many laws that people have been carved out of just because, and I want to be clear, not because they are violent people, but because they committed an offense that has the label violent next to it. And we can get more into what that means.
Let's do.
Right, right. So, you know, I think part of the reason that carve-outs are so wrong is because they reinforce some of the worst aspects about mass incarceration. And one of them is this notion that people can be reduced to labels like violent offender or offender at all, right? The idea of a carve-out, right, is that we're going to make this law more palatable to the voting, you know, to the voters who, you know, stand to pass it or to, you know, who stand to, you know, protest against it if it's passed, and we're going to make it, you know, we're going to make it safer. We're going to, you know, reduce the potential risks of this, you know, such and such reform, that expands parole or expands voting rights or whatever, by carving out people who don't deserve it somehow. We really have no way of determining who deserves it or not in a, you know, in an expedient manner. So what these laws usually do is they say, if you have, you know, if your offense has this and this label, you're out, right? And typically, you know, this capitalizes on something that has been present in the justice system for, you know, many decades, which is the nonviolent and violent distinction. Somebody who, for example, obviously there's, you know, if you steal a backpack, that's not the same as committing murder, right? One of those things is clearly a more violent offense than the other one. But there is a lot of gray area, right? Hurting or killing someone during a domestic abuse incident where they're abusing you, is that a violent offense? Is that more of a violent offense than committing first degree murder, right? Is, why is it that going into a, you know, if you commit, in many places, if you commit robbery and you happen to have a gun on you, that's a violent offense. And I guess I'm not just speaking about the sort of senselessness of trying to distinguish certain people from others as more violent, you know, their offenses as more violent from others. I'm also just talking about the complete unwillingness of legislators to consider these individuals as individual people, right? When we talk about something like increasing eligibility for parole, a law that increases parole eligibility across the entire prison population, and then excluding violent people who committed violent offenses from that reform, what that means is that, you know, parole, right, that's a case-by-case process. If the parole board does not think that you're fit to be released, they don't grant you parole. And this law doubles down on this by saying, we're not even going to consider you for parole, right? Because you have this label next to the offense that you committed, you are not eligible even to be considered for early release by this board that has been chosen by the state for their discretionary power. And I think that is a step way over the line demonizing certain people and taking away, you know, their hope at redemption.
And for what it's worth, the FBI's UCR includes robbery under violent offenses. So if they're going to use a simple definition like the FBI's from the NCIC, then violent offenses does include robbery. That's
right.
What kind of impacts are these having on incarceration?
Well, the main impact, and I wish I could show visually the graph. Maybe you can put it on the website. But in our report, we graph the change in the prison population disaggregated by violent versus nonviolent. So what we show is that the percent of state prison populations, or the population of people in state prison labeled violent, right, has gone down by only 2%. Between 2009 and 2019. But in all other categories. So people, the prison population that's not labeled violent has gone down by 20% over that same period of time. So the effect that these criminal justice reforms have had when they have excluded people convicted of violent offenses is to seriously, basically leave out people convicted of these offenses from abilities to leave prison, right? Or abilities to, and I should say also on the front end, has really foreclosed on the possibility of giving different pathways out of the criminal justice system or different pathways towards accountability for people convicted of violent offenses who are going into the system. So whereas someone today who, I remember I saw in one of our lists of carve outs, there were some laws that are designed for mothers, right? If you are a criminal defendant and you're a mother, there are certain options for pretrial pretrial or post-trial diversion from prison, unless you are a mother convicted of or charged with a violent offense. That certainly does not have to be a violent offense towards your children. And, you know, most of the time it will not have been. But it's an automatic exclusion of a lot of people who, I mean, the reform recognizes these people are in need of, deserving of special treatment, not just for their own sake, but for their kids, and then takes this absolutely senseless step of excluding a giant proportion of people who are, you know, who stand to be impacted by this. That's kind of a long-winded answer, but there it is.
The Prison Policy Initiative has released a new carve-outs toolkit. Tell us about that.
So the new resource that we released was authored by my colleague, Sarah. She's our advocacy and policy manager. What she did was she put together not just a list of more or less all the facts that I've just given you, but also a list of common arguments in favor of carve-outs and then some arguments against them. So if you're an advocate and you are fighting for criminal justice reform and you're bumping up against legislators who say, well, this is a good idea, but I think, you know, I don't want a violent offender to benefit from this, let's carve them out, this toolkit's for you. So we go through the common arguments like, okay, we're going to start with people convicted of nonviolent offenses in this reform, and then later we're going to come back for people convicted of other offenses. Or arguments like, we can't include people convicted of violent offenses because victims of crime are going to get really upset. They don't want that. And so we respond to some of those arguments. In particular, we talk about the polling data that shows that in a resounding manner, people who are victims of violent crime want investments in rehabilitation and prevention of crime much more than they want more incarceration. They would, I think something like 80% prefer investing more in rehabilitation and mental health treatment, whereas like 10% prefer investing more in prisons and jails. So this is a toolkit for a very particular audience in pushing back against legislators that don't know better or who may actually actively want to appear tough on crime by carving out these populations.
Well, and I think, frankly, generally useful. That argument about crime victims comes up frequently, and it always bothers me when I see or hear a reporter talking about how that, well, the only people I ever hear from are these. It's like, well, maybe mm-hmm. you need to look outside of the people who have your cell phone number.
Right.
So now, how can people find this toolkit?
So this is, it's on our website, prisonpolicy.org, and it's part of a larger toolkit that we have for advocates and just people considering getting into advocacy. It's called our Advocacy Toolkit. So if you go to our website, go to the button called Publications, and then in the navigation bar, you'll see Advocacy Toolkit. We've got a bunch of other stuff there too, like a guide to submitting FOIA requests and a guide to looking for data sources and all that stuff.
Do you have any other campaigns or new stuff coming out? You do have a lot of stuff at the website. It's impressive.
Thank you. The other one I guess I'll spotlight right now is we have a lot of resources for people who are fighting jail expansion. So it's sort of similar to the carve-outs issue in the sense that It's sort of this overlooked part of the criminal justice system. Local jails expanding the number of beds that they have tends to actually facilitate more incarceration, even though oftentimes the jails are expanded, you know, due to claims that the current one is overcrowded. That's a whole thing as well that, you know, I could get into. But if you're working to combat the expansion of a local jail, or if your county is proposing a brand new expensive jail and you're trying to oppose that, we have a bunch of resources for you, including a webinar, recorded webinar, led by people who were part of some successful fights to curb the building of new jails. So that's all also in our advocacy toolkit.
How can people learn more about Prison Policy Initiative and support the work you're doing? Well, what's your social media, website, and all that?
Yeah, well, we're on all the big ones. We're on Twitter at Prison Policy. We're on Facebook at Prison Policy Init, I think. Instagram at Prison Policy. We're also on Threads and Blue Sky and the other places that, or just those two. But as people, if you're a refugee from Twitter, we're on the main places that people are going from that too.
Any closing thoughts for the listeners?
I just hope it, you know, if you do happen to be an advocate working on these issues, and you know, you want some support or you have questions for us, please get in touch. The advocacy toolkit and all the stuff we're creating right now is part of an effort to support people who are trying to do this work, and we're trying to do as much as possible to answer the questions and produce the data and reports that can strengthen local campaigns. So yeah, please get in touch with us. There's a contact page on our website.
Wanda Bertram, thank you so much.
Thanks, Doug.
That was my conversation with Wanda Bertram, communications strategist at the Prison Policy Initiative. Find their Carve Outs toolkit and many more resources at their website, prisonpolicy.org. That's prisonpolicy.org. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. And according to the Iron Law of Prohibition, the U.S. war on drugs made the rise of fentanyl inevitable. Deaths from a toxic drug supply and overdose have risen dramatically over the last several years across all of that part of Abya Yala now referred to as North America. Reforms are making headway in various states and provinces, but legislative change takes time. And while the drug warriors are bloviating and the political moderates are dithering, people are dying. Individuals and organizations in harm reduction are working hard to save as many lives as they can. Communities across the U.S. are finally embracing some of the innovative interventions that have been proven effective by research and real-life experience around the world. Safer smoking kits are one such intervention. To discuss safer smoking kits and other life-saving measures, I'm joined by Haven Wheelock, Harm Reduction Services Manager at Outside In. What are safer smoking supplies?
Yeah, so safer smoking supplies can be different things to different people. In this context, we are talking about smoking supplies for illicit drugs. The conversation around safer smoking in regards to things like cannabis and nicotine is a different conversation. But in terms of when we're talking about smoking supplies for more stigmatized drugs like heroin, fentanyl, methamphetamines, cocaine. We're talking about distributing things like glass pipes, filters for like char and filters to keep drugs and to smoke drugs with. Yes, and that also includes things like aluminum foil and straws that people use to smoke substances off of.
So why do people... Is it seems it almost it, you know, this kind of sounds like a silly question to ask, because I grew up with both of my parents smoking two packs of cigarettes each every day. So
which kills more people than all other illicit substances combined,
and had me wheezing all the way through high school when I finally moved until I finally moved away. But why do people smoke illegal drugs?
Smoking is one of the many ways that people put drugs into their body, right? Many drugs can be eaten, can be smoked, can be snorted, can be booty bumped. There's a lot injected. There are a lot of ways that people get drugs into their bodies. And smoking is one of the faster ways to do that. It is also one of the safer ways in terms of being able to control how much of a substance you're taking at a time. So if I am smoking something and I take a hit of it and I'm like, ooh, I'm good, I don't have to finish that the rest of that dose in that moment. I can save it for later. I can get rid of it. Whereas if I eat a pill, if I inject something, that entire dose is now in me, and therefore, like, I can't do less of it, right? Whereas when I'm smoking, I can do a hit, see how I feel, and then make the determination if I want to do more or not. It's similar to, like, the difference between, like, sipping a beer and doing a shot.
Or smoking a or smoking a bong or a pipe versus eating a big old honking brownie. Exactly.
Yep.
Now, are people smoking fentanyl? It's an opioid.
Yeah. So it's actually been a fascinating thing to watch. I've been working with people who use drugs for 20 years, and like the goal of getting people to transition from injecting something to smoking something is a really hard sell. But as fentanyl has come onto the market with fentanyl compared to the heroin they were doing previously, and people have really transitioned from injecting heroin to smoking fentanyl. We've seen the number of visits to our syringe service program decline. The number of syringes we give out has dropped dramatically over the last 2 years. And so people really are making that transition, in part because they don't want to die of overdose. Additionally, you know, poking yourself hurts. Right? Like, people, like, it is a more pleasant experience to be able to smoke something as opposed to have to inject it.
Well, and not to put too fine a point on it, but one of the reasons syringe services programs started in the first place was to prevent the transmission of HIV. And that's,
I mean, there are so many, you know, like, if there's so many like benefits to smoking versus injecting in terms of HIV transmission, hepatitis C transmission, things like endocarditis, osteomyelitis, skin and soft tissue infections. Like, it is a safer route of transmission than injecting. Period.
Right on. And of course, we're not saying that anything is necessarily risk-free. That's all these things are relative.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, the safest way to do fentanyl is to not do it. Right. And like, being able to engage people who are smoking fentanyl currently and like help connect them to care while they're like, when people come in, we are able to like engage them in understanding their healthcare, understanding what's going on in their bodies, help them connect to care if that is what they want. And like, being able to like build those relationships and that trust and like create that pipeline for folks who, if no pun intended, create that pathway for folks to engage in care and like possibly get on medicine or possibly go to treatment or any of those things. Like, we want to do that. And if we can keep, and we want to do that ideally before they transition to injecting, or transition back to injecting is probably the more realistic way to frame that, since so many folks have transitioned from injecting heroin to smoking. It's like, it's not inevitable, but it is a terrifying thought that people are starting to and will continue to increase injection.
Xylazine's all over the news. We're seeing instances of it in various places around the country. Have there been any reports of xylazine or of just unexplained skin wounds and abscesses and such among folks in our area here around Multnomah County?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have had one confirmed xylazine and fentanyl-related deaths in Multnomah County that was reported several months ago. It was a death from September, back in September, because our death data is incredibly slow. So knowing what's people are dying from is a slow thing. That's a whole different beast. But we're not seeing a lot of evidence of xylazine in our community right now, based on our drug checking data. We are not really seeing xylazine. We have had a couple samples that, like, of people intentionally searching out xylazine. But it is definitely not, we are not looking at what they're looking at in Philly.
And there was another thing, which is I'm seeing in places like Vancouver, BC, and seeing it showing up a few other areas with benzodiazepines being thrown into the mix as a contaminant with some of the opioids. Are you seeing any of that down here?
We are not necessarily seeing benzos in the opioids. We are seeing opioids in the benzos. So we are seeing, like, illicit pills that are being sold as benzodiazepines that do contain fentanyl. But we are not really seeing it the other way around.
Any closing thoughts for our listeners?
One, thank you, Doug, for always inviting me on and, like, helping to, like, clarify the misinformation that is happening and supporting harm reduction in the work we do. That's a big closing thought, is, like, I really appreciate you for bringing this up and having this conversation. Harm reduction saves lives. And, like, as much as we do need, and, like, our people who are mad about what we're doing right now are often being like, we need more treatment, we need more detox, we need more on-demand services. And they're not wrong. But those things are going to take time to create. And harm reduction is here to keep people alive while we do that work as well. It is not that or this, it is all of it. And so, if anyone questions why harm reduction is important, we are pro-treatment. We are pro access to treatment. We are not, like, we want to help people be as healthy as they can be and they want to be. And we also acknowledge that, like, it is really hard to get into treatment right now, and no one should die while we wait. And we don't want people to die waiting for that other, much more expensive, much bigger lift to happen.
That was my conversation with Haven Wheelock from Outside In. Full disclosure, I'm a supporter of Outside In. They do vital work and have saved countless lives, maybe even the life of someone you love and hold dear. Find them on the web at outsidein.org. That's outsidein.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Many thanks to my guests, Wanda Bertram from the Prison Policy Initiative and Haven Wheelock from Outside In. And thanks especially to you, dear listener. You make it all worth it, and you make all this possible. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just as so long.